Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's one way to cut the deficit. Help the economy grow. Not all budget cuts are created equal, you know. How old buildings might be greener than you thought, and your letters on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Toyota. Toyota is sharing technology and ideas for a better world. Learn more at toyota.com/ideas for good. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 17th of November. Good to have you with us. We will begin today with what looks like the start of a fix for the foreclosure mess. State attorneys general who are looking into accusations of shoddy paperwork are working on a deal with some of the big mortgage lenders. There are the usual protestations about nothing being agreed to yet. But one idea that is said to be part of the package is some kind of fund to compensate homeowners who were wrongfully foreclosed upon. A pool of money, the theory goes, may offer quicker relief than the court system would. And the banking industry would probably get behind something like that. But is there a check big enough to make up for having your home wrongfully taken away? Economic victim funds can turn thin and watery pretty fast. And this one would be especially broad and necessarily complicated. Marketplace's Janet Babin explores the goods and the bads of a foreclosure fund.
The foreclosure fund is still a work in progress, but could include compensation for a wide swath of problems, from shoddy paperwork to fraud. Steptoe & Johnson attorney Bill Hassler has represented homeowners who've suffered foreclosure fraud.
The goal is admirable. It's to do rough justice without trying to account for every penny.
But with foreclosures, the pennies will have to spread far and wide. Hassler says companies have used these funds with mixed results.
Some funds have worked very well, but in terms of the mortgage situation, unfortunately, it's a very, very difficult problem. I think you're going to run into a problem with some people being undercompensated and others perhaps being overcompensated.
The money for the fund would come from the banking industry, but that's probably okay with them. Analyst Nancy Bush with NAB Research says that's what's going to happen anyway.
I mean, the political realities are today the banking industry gets blamed for something, they pay money. Life goes on.
Bush says the industry wants to get out of the spotlight so legal foreclosures can get back on track. Georgetown law professor Adam Levitin says the banks have a vested interest in finding a quick resolution.
The banks want to settle and have this go away quickly because they're scared that the attorneys general will dig deeper.
And he says find even more irregularities. The Iowa Attorney General's office says a foreclosure fund is just one solution on the table, a settlement in this 50-state probe. Still a ways off. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
There was another bipartisan deficit reduction plan released today, the second in as many weeks, and there are various combinations of spending cuts and tax increases being bandied about out there. But in his column today in the New York Times, David Leonhardt writes that cutting the deficit isn't always about cutting the budget. Economic growth can help you get there as well. David, as always, good to talk to you again.
It's nice to be on.
So this idea of cutting the deficit with economic growth, how does it work? What are the mechanics?
Well, when the economy grows, people make more money. And when they make more money, they also pay more in taxes. And that tax money goes into the Treasury, and it makes it easier to pay off the national debt. And that's roughly what happened in the two decades after World War II, and then again in the late 90s. It wasn't the only reason we were able to pay off the debt so well then, but it was probably the most important.
How much growth does it take to make a difference? I mean, if we bump GDP by, you know, 0.5%, is that going to do it?
Oh, absolutely. The good news is it doesn't take anything like 2 or 3 percentage points a year of GDP growth to make a difference. If we bumped growth up by 0.5 percentage point over the next 20 years, we'd probably cut our deficit problem about in half. The bad news is that bumping up growth by 0.5% a year every year is actually not so easy by any means. There isn't a secret formula for doing it. We don't know exactly how to do it. We can make some guesses, but it's not that easy.
Well, there have been a couple of proposals the past couple of weeks, deficit commissions on the presidential commission and then another one today. What do they point to and what do you like there?
These are both bipartisan commissions, and there's a lot to chew on. I think the first thing it's important to say is Our deficit debate for most of the last year or so has been maddeningly vague. And both of these commissions have put specific proposals on the table. And I don't love every aspect of each one, but I think it's important to start by saying that. In terms of trying to push economic growth, there's some good news and some less good news. The good news is they both push tax reform, the idea that we want to clean up our tax code and not have people and businesses waste so much time trying to qualify for different tax breaks. The bad news is I don't think either one of them does enough to emphasize things like education and science that over the long haul have really been wonderful drivers of economic growth. And so I worry that things like that would get lost in the general rush to cut spending. They'd get cut along with a lot of things that in fact do nothing to promote growth.
Give me a couple of examples of things that do nothing to promote growth.
I would guess that farm subsidies do nothing or approximately nothing to promote growth. I would guess a lot of the military spending we now do does nothing to promote growth and probably does very little to protect us. I certainly think we can look at cuts of 10, maybe even 20%. And then there's healthcare. Healthcare is the big item. We spend by far more than any other rich country on healthcare. We don't get, on the whole, much better results. Depending how you look at it, maybe we get a little bit better results, but certainly we don't get the kind of results we should be getting for the amount of money we're spending.
I was talking to a guy the other day who said, you know, as bad as it is now with the deficit and with concerns about government spending, it's going to have to get worse. Our backs are going to have to get closer to the wall before anything substantive happens.
I agree with that. And I think one of the ways you can see that is that right now, no politicians are really willing to tell the truth about this. The people who are willing to say we can't have Medicare, Social Security, the military, and tax rates as they are people who don't have to run for office. They're journalists like me. They're people who serve on these committees who maybe used to have to run for office but don't anymore. And so I agree that we're probably not at the point yet where we're actually going to solve this thing.
David Leonhardt writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times. David, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Choppy, bumpy, unsettled, all equally appropriate to describe Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Today's election day for the 112th Congress. Democrats and Republicans who are going to be in the House when it convenes in January chose their leadership this afternoon. No new names. Nancy Pelosi for the Democrats, John Boehner for the GOP. He'll be the new speaker come January. Of course, there are a couple of weeks left yet in the current session, and that small matter of what to do about the Bush tax cuts, keep them or let them go. Here's commentator Robert Reich.
The Bush tax cut should be extended, not just to families earning up to $250,000, but up to $500,000 for 2 years. In other words, to everyone except the top 1%. Why not the top 1%? Because they don't need it and don't deserve it. The top 1% now takes home almost a quarter of the nation's total income. That's up from 10% as recently as 1980. A wide chasm has opened up between the upper middle class, lawyers, doctors, and small business owners, and the very rich, now in executive suites and on Wall Street, who rake in millions. Extending the tax cut to them would create almost no economic stimulus because they spend a much smaller proportion of their income than everyone else. But it would cost $130 billion over 2 years, blowing a giant hole in the deficit. I'd rather use that $130 billion to rehire every teacher, firefighter, and police officer laid off over the last 2 years and save jobs that are now on the chopping block. Supply-side economists argue that the top 1% will stop working as hard if they have to go back to paying what they did under Bill Clinton. That's baloney. The Clinton years were great years for them, and the Bush tax cuts they received never trickled down anyway. Between 2001 and 2007, the median wage actually dropped. So, will Congress do the right thing and not extend the Bush tax cuts to the top 1%? Don't hold your breath. The political power of the top 1% is evident in everything from hedge fund and private equity fund managers who can treat their incomes as capital gains, subject to just a 15% tax, to multi-million-dollar home interest deductions on executive mansions. But it's possible Americans have had it with power and privilege at the top. Many people are mad as hell and not going to take it anymore.
Robert Reich was the Secretary of Labor for President Clinton in his first term. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Next week, back in his regular spot on the broadcast, David Frum. As always, your thoughts are welcome anytime. Marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Maybe it's just me, but it kind of seems like some of the big tech companies, Apple and Google and Facebook, are launching new products or services every single day. And honestly, some of them seem a little bit off. Just today, Amazon said it's getting into the movie-making business. It's going to post scripts online, let the public vote, and then send the winners off to Warner Brothers. Basically, they're all just throwing new things at the wall and seeing what sticks. Marketplace's Steve Henn explains the tech mentality.
So far this week, Google's launched a restaurant and travel review service called Hotpot, teased reporters with a glimpse of a phone that could one day replace your wallet, unveiled a fashion site called Boutique.com, and released a Google Voice app for iPhones. And that's just Google, and it's just this week, and it's only Wednesday. The pace of innovation in the tech industry today is unprecedented, and you don't have to take my word for it. Here's tech analyst Mary Meeker at the Web 2.0 Summit in San Francisco yesterday.
I've never seen this in my career following technology companies over the course of the last couple decades, whether it's Apple, Google, Amazon.
And so these companies are sitting on mountains of cash. Apple has $51 billion in the bank, Google more than $30 billion, and many of their new online ventures are cheap to start. This is how Google's CEO Eric Schmidt described his strategy at Web 2.0. He says he keeps an eye out for any idea with the potential for explosive growth.
Indeed, we've now come along to a view which we call hockey stick, where we're looking for these hockey sticks in these products and we just pour resources onto them.
And other companies are also moving at the same manic pace. Mary Meeker says there's a pretty simple reason. If you made a list of the 15 largest tech companies by market cap in 2004,
seven of the companies that were on the list of 2004 didn't make it to the list in 2010.
She says firms either innovate or die. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Coming up, what's that? You say you're looking to build a shiny new sustainable home for yourself? Well, take heed.
The greenest building is the one that's already built.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street found its feet today after Tuesday's drubbing. The Dow Industrial shed 15 points, just over a 10%, closed at 11,007. The NASDAQ picked up 6 points, a 0.25%, 2476 at the bell. The S&P 500 basically flat, ended things at 1178. For the second day running, retail stocks offered surprising pre-holiday cheer. Target hit the mark with strong earnings and a forecast that its holiday sales are going to be the best in 3 years. Shares jumped 3.9%. Costco Wholesale rang up a nearly 2% gain. Saks showed luxury buyers are in. Its shares leapt 2.75%. On the eve of General Motors' return to the big board, Ford kept its foot on the gas, rose 1% today. Bank of America lost 2.75%. Morgan Stanley shed 2.1%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.88%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com. By Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 127 hours based on the story of Aaron Ralston from director Danny Boyle and starring James Franco, now in select theaters. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
on the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, shiny, sparkly things. The Hope Diamond goes on display in its new temporary setting called Embracing Hope. It's happening at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. And the House Financial Services Committee holds a hearing on robo-signing and other issues in mortgage servicing. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
It's Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
It's Wednesday. Time to sort through the inbox, hear what you have to say. And we're going to start things off this week with a salty, tasty treat. Wendy's is rolling out some new French fries, as we told you last week, seasoned with sea salt instead of regular old table salt. Our story brought forth the health-minded among you, including Dr. John Mesmer of Palmyra, Pennsylvania.
Sea salt tastes different because of the minerals present in addition to sodium, but it is not healthier. There are ways for people to use sea salt. I use it myself in cooking, but one must understand how much is acceptable.
The Marketplace foodie contingent was also talking about our piece yesterday on the rising costs of eating more of what's good for you. Sarah Delavan lives right here in Los Angeles.
I feel bad saying this, but I believe this article does a disservice to any reader who doesn't already know better. My husband and I eat a fully organic diet, including meats, on a budget of $40 a week or less.
Catherine Sloan of Smithville, Tennessee, was irked by our choice of words as we explained the Bush tax cuts and why the discussion of whether to extend them or not turns on that $250,000 pivot. We said for the 0.1% of Americans that take in more than $2.2 million a year, those tax cuts mean an average $500,000, and this is where we get into trouble, windfall, we said. Windfall, Ms. Sloan points out, sounds like winning the lottery rather than people getting to keep their own money. Would you, she wrote, describe a tax increase as a windfall for the government? We also looked into the government creating an online privacy czar last week. James Daly wrote from Seattle to say that marketers spying on you can have its upsides.
If I, as a single employed male living in Seattle, never have to see a feminine hygiene wash ad or a diapers ad or a debt consolidation ad, then it's a win for society as a whole. The advertisers save their money and I save my time.
Time saved is never a bad thing, so we're going to wrap it up just in time for you to send us your thoughts about what you hear on the broadcast. Weigh in online at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Felix Rowetton knows a little something about financial dealings. He's been a power broker on Wall Street for half a century. He was in the room for some of the biggest deals ever, RJR Nabisco being bought by Kohlberg Kravis Roberts about 30 years ago, NBC being bought by General Electric. And somewhere along the way, he also found time to help save New York City from default. That story and others are the backbone of his new memoir, Dealings, it's called. When we spoke, I asked Felix Rowetton about what it was like trying to keep New York City on the financial map.
Well, we had tried to fix the finances of the city without going bankrupt. And in order to do that, we needed the cooperation of all kinds of people who up to now had not cooperated with us, principally the labor unions, who knew that ultimately if the city went bankrupt, their pension funds were going bankrupt. And so they began to cooperate with us, which was a first in the industry. And we were able to finance the restructuring of the city's debt.
Hmm.
And we got this done within 2 days of default.
Let me fast forward now from New York City and its troubles in the 1970s to Wall Street and its troubles 2.5, 3 years ago. There is a scene in this book. You're sitting in your apartment about to open the morning paper. You unfold it and you see the headline, Lehman Brothers goes bankrupt. What went through your mind?
I couldn't believe it. I mean, my whole career had been spent in this industry where the big people didn't really go bankrupt. That was not part of the social construct. And so the notion that Lehman would go bankrupt was just totally something unthinkable, but it happened.
Is there a way that banking ever gets back to not the way it was 60 years ago when you got into it, but where the interests of the shareholder and the customer are more paramount than they seem to be now, where it's not all about profit and the bottom line? Can that ever happen again?
Well, I think it's difficult. We actually had a discussion at the RJR Nabisco board meeting with respect to these issues of social contracts, of taking into account issues that are more than just financial issues.
And this is that very famous deal, RJR Nabisco and Colbert Kravis Roberts. I mean, that's the biggest leverage buyout in history at the time. And you were talking
about this.
You were talking about this 30 years ago.
Absolutely. But nobody really wanted to talk about it, you know, because it inhibited people and the standards were difficult. It wasn't something that you could just snap your fingers and say, okay, from now on, this is what we're going to be looking at. But it troubled enough people, especially there was one man who was, I think, the chairman of one of the computer companies, who was absolutely convinced that you couldn't have any equity and any fairness unless you took into account not only the price of the shares, but benefits to the stockholders, to the people around the company, but maybe not necessarily of it.
How do you explain the disconnect between how Wall Street is seen by the average American after this crisis, and I think how Wall Street probably sees itself, which is contributing to the economy and to the public good?
Well, and you see, probably both are to some extent true. I mean, the investment house that says, why am I being pilloried in the newspapers when I'm doing something that I think is good for the country, which is to keep this economy going? And that's also true until, you know, some huge banking house declares bankruptcy and almost brings the whole industry down.
The latest book from Felix Rohatyn is called Dealings. It's a memoir. It's called Political and a Financial Life. Mr. Rohatyn, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
You can read some of the stories Felix Rohatyn tells in Dealings on the WhizBang new book section on our website. It's called The Big Book. You can post your comments, hear other book interviews. You can shop, do it all online at marketplace.org/thebigbook. In Chicago, Illinois, today the talk is of kitchen countertops made from recycled soda bottles and insulation made out of old blue jeans. The Green Building Conference started this morning, the newest construction techniques and design methods that are going to help save the planet. But there is a school of thought out there that, for buildings at least, new isn't as green as old is. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Troe reports.
The TV show World's Greenest Homes has the air of the lifestyles of the rich and famous.
This 3,200-square-foot weekender functions entirely on its own energy, thanks to solar power, a wind turbine, and rain collection.
And that's how most people visualize a green building. Big, angular, new, and armed with the latest energy technology. But some argue that's the wrong idea. Real green building looks more like this.
Hi, I'm Bob Vila. Welcome to this old house. I've got something to show you.
Historic preservationists say renovating an old building is almost always better for the environment than framing up a new one. You don't add to sprawl by taking up more land, and you don't waste all the energy and resources, like wood and metal, already in existing buildings. But people don't often equate old buildings with going green. Take Blenda Wright's historic bungalow in Claremont, California.
Come on in.
Thanks. And this is the Green and Green Darling home, is that right?
Green and Green Darling Wright home. Been here since 1903.
To be clear, this Green and Green has no relation to today's concept of going green. At the turn of the 20th century, brothers and architects Charles and Henry Green launched the arts and crafts movement. When the Wrights bought the house, they loved its built-in fixtures and old-growth wood beams, but not the way it leaked air.
Were you afraid of, like, I'm going to live in this drafty old house?
Yes!
They hired designer Bill Baldwin to green the house without compromising the green and green aesthetic.
They thought about harmony and balance and detail.
He combined that style with technology to make this the first historic home to earn a green rating from the state of California. There's no rain-collecting roof or solar panels. That wouldn't look authentic. And besides, Baldwin aimed to prove that a green home doesn't have to look futuristic. He hid high-tech insulation behind the vintage wainscoting.
We did an inch of closed-cell foam to seal it. Then we put in the blown-in cellulose.
And the warm glow from the stained glass lighting fixtures?
It's a fluorescent light, so highly energy efficient, but until you look underneath the shade, you wouldn't know.
The house earned its credentials imperceptibly.
The thing I'm most proud of is that you can't tell.
But that green rating is important, says Scott Horst. He runs the most popular system for measuring the environmental impact of buildings. It's called LEED.
Existing buildings that become LEED buildings also have a higher value, and value tends to incentivize buildings to stay around.
Meaning they're less likely to be torn down. He says if you reuse a building, you do get points toward LEED certification, but it's a small percentage of the total points needed, says Emily Wadhams at the National Trust for Historic Preservation.
We feel it sends a signal to the marketplace that reusing a building simply isn't that valuable or important.
She says it will always be easier to build in energy efficiency from scratch. But if renovation got more credit from the get-go, more people would do it. And the definition of green building might change from new high-tech weekend homes to something like this.
The greenest building is the one that's already built.
In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace. Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. By the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt, it's more car than electric. And by Putnam Investments, helping investors save for retirement since 1937. For the latest retirement news, you can talk to your advisor, then visit RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today offered in our collective capacity as the owners of General Motors. GM priced its initial public offering this afternoon, $33 a piece, right about at the top range of earlier guesses. In all, it's going to be about $22, maybe $23 billion worth. When shares start trading tomorrow, the IPO is going to take the U.S. government's stake in GM down to about half of the 61% it's at right now. We do still own 500 million shares, though. The AP did the math. Those shares would have to sell at $53 a piece to get taxpayers all their money back. Ticker symbol, by the way, as it should be, GM, General Motors. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow shed 15 points, just over a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ picked up 6 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 basically flat. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, if you're frustrated with Wall Street, you might want to check out a little bank on the prairie.
There are competitors out there. They simply can deliver at reduced fees, et cetera, et cetera. Our niche is based on a customer intimacy model.
Our series on Globalization Economy 4.0 is back tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.